content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, should parents stay home to raise kids, and should the government pay them for it? By Emily Oster. Most Americans on the left and the right agree that supporting families is a good idea, but they have different ideas about how to do it. People on the left tend to talk about subsidies to help families with two working parents pay for childcare, whereas those on the right would prefer payments to help parents stay home with their children. On this issue, policymakers have waded in to one of the most fraught battles of the, quote, mommy wars, whether children are better off if both parents work or if one stays home. I've seen tensions flare over this issue online and on the playground. Some people suggest that moms who work don't care about their children. Others suggest that moms who don't work outside the home are lazy or wasting their talents. Both sides, it's worth noting, invariably focus on moms instead of dads. Everyone believes there's a right way to do things, and mostly the right way is my way. This comes from a good place. We all want to do what is best for our family, and any choice we make is hard. When we want so badly for our choice to be the right one, we may feel the need to believe that it must be right for everyone. However, if the government is going to pass policies that encourage people to make a certain choice, we as society had better be confident that the choice contributes to the greater good. Government policy is designed to discourage smoking, for example, because we have clear and definitive evidence showing that smoking is bad for health. But parental work is not like smoking. We have no comparable data demonstrating which arrangement is best, in part because families with two working parents differ in multiple ways from those with a single working parent. Any difference in kids' outcomes is hard to attribute to parental work alone. The best evidence relies on variations in leave policy. We know that a few months of paid maternity leave has positive effects on babies and families. Infant health improves and infant mortality decreases. In some studies, maternity leave also affected the baby's future education and wages. But what about after the first few months? A number of European countries have extended parental leave to a year or even 15 months. This lets us ask, whether there are benefits to babies being home with a parent for this extended period. The answer seems to be no. Extending parental leave does not appear to influence children's future test scores, and it doesn't appear to have any other effect on their well-being once they reach early adulthood. Separating correlation from causation is even more difficult for older children. However, when we look at all the data together, as for example in a 2008 meta-analysis, the impact of maternal work on children's test scores, educational completion, and health measures such as obesity seem to be, on average, zero. There are some nuances in the data. Researchers have found a small positive correlation between child test scores and having one parent working part-time and one full-time. This configuration is most common in higher-income households, however, which may be what explains the difference. Researchers have also found that having two full or part-time working parents seems to be beneficial for children in poorer families more than in richer ones. But overall, even if we take all of these differences as causal, which is a stretch, the differences themselves remain extremely small. The natural conclusion is that when it comes to children's outcomes, parental work configuration probably doesn't matter very much in either direction. There is no best choice. In my household, both parents work because we want to. But individual families will make different choices because they face different preferences and constraints. This is true of virtually all the decisions we make as families. where to vacation, what color car to buy, and government policy should not try to encourage one choice over another. We would not want federal policy to subsidize trips to Disney World just because a particular politician loves it there. Does this mean the government has no place in supporting families? No. What the government can and should do is look for externalities. An externality occurs when the behavior of one person affects another or society overall. The government may want to discourage a behavior resulting in a negative externality and encourage a behavior resulting in a positive externality. You can make an externality-based argument for child care subsidies. When people stay in the workforce after they have children, they pay more taxes. This is true both because of the years parents work while their children are young, and also because those years are an investment in higher wages later, meaning more contributions to Social Security and more retirement savings. This has social value. Having a large tax base, especially as the country ages, is important. Individual work has, therefore, a positive externality. If people are leaving the labor force because they can't find or pay for childcare, as some have said they are, then the government may well have a role in fixing this. This is the reason that many other countries have government-subsidized childcare. You can't make this kind of argument in favor of the reverse, subsidizing parents to stay home full-time, because the loss of their tax dollars would have a major negative externality. You can, however, make a case for policies that would support some of the efforts of stay-at-home parents. Much of the American school system, for better or worse, is built on the unpaid labor of parents, disproportionately moms who do not work outside the home. Parents who serve in the PTA, organize fundraisers, chaperone trips, and volunteer in the classroom have huge external, positive externalities. Paying them for this work would be an efficient and reasonable policy choice. It does not seem a stretch for both sides to agree that America would benefit from making it easier for parents to volunteer in schools and easier for them to pay taxes. If we can accept that there is not one correct way to run your family, then we can focus on using government policy to give parents more choices instead of fewer ones. Next, Go Ahead and Fail by Arthur C. Brooks. Perfectionism can make you miserable. Here's how you can muster the courage to mess up. This is part of the How to Build a Life weekly column by Arthur Brooks. For years, I was haunted by a fear of failure. I spent my early adulthood as a professional French hornist, playing in chamber music ensembles and orchestras. Classical music is a perilous business, relying on absolute precision. Playing the French horn, prone as it is to missing notes, is a virtual high-wire act in every concert. I could go from hero to goat within a few mistakes during a solo. I lived in dread, and it made my life and work misery. Fear of failure is not just a problem for French hornists. Looking bad in front of others is arguably the most common dread people face. This explains why, for example, researchers have found that public speaking is college students' most common fear. Some scholars have famously asserted that people fear it even more than death. And dread about failing doesn't just afflict the young or the inexperienced. According to a 2018 survey conducted by the Norwest Venture Partners, 90% of CEOs admit fear of failure keeps them up at night more than any other concern. This particular brand of anxiety appears to be on the rise. According to the World Bank, the percentage of American adults who see good opportunities to start a business but indicate that fear of failure would prevent them from doing so has been increasing for the past two decades. It is approaching the world median in spite of the fact that the U.S. has long prided itself in being a land of intrepid entrepreneurs. There are a few possible explanations for this increase. Social media threatens to make every slip-up an extinction-level event, socially and professionally. Meanwhile, a generation of overprotective baby boomer parents have shielded their millennial and Gen Z kids from the small risks and failures that build the emotional fortitude required to withstand the inevitable larger failures of adulthood. To the extent that this trend extinguishes entrepreneurial behavior, it's bad enough for our future. But I am less worried about the effect on startup enterprises than on the enterprise of building happy lives. Fear of failure can have surprisingly harsh consequences for our well-being. For some, it can lead to a debilitating anxiety and depression, a diagnosable malady called atychophobia. But even before it reaches that point, it can steer us away from life's joyful, fulfilling adventures by discouraging us from taking risks and trying new things. The fear of failure has a number of sources, not all of which are obvious. At first thought, it might seem like it is a dread of some known bad outcome. For example, I might be afraid to give a presentation for my boss because if I fail, I won't get a promotion, with clear implications for my career. But the fear of failure seems to actually be about unknown outcomes, at least for some who are the most anxious. In one recent study conducted by the University College London, psychologists devised an experiment in which participants had to decide between a series of gambles with guaranteed rewards and a set of bets with potentially higher wins and losses. Based on this, they found that people who suffered from anxiety were the most unable to estimate the best possible reward, which is consistent with earlier research. The implication of this risk aversion is that if you are particularly anxious about failing, it's the uncertainty about whether you will do so that bothers you more than the actual consequences. Researchers have also found that people who strongly fear failure have a composite of two personality characteristics. Low achievement orientation, that is, they don't take much pleasure from accomplishments and meeting goals, and high test anxiety, a fear of performing well at a crucial moment. In other words, they're motivated less by the possibility of winning and gaining something of value, and more by their anxiety about the possibility of messing up. Those are some of the same personality traits that drive perfectionism and can show up in low achievers and high achievers alike. In fact, perfectionism and the fear of failure go hand in hand. They lead you to believe that success isn't about doing something good, but about not doing something bad. If you suffer from a fear of failure, you'll know exactly what I mean. Where striving for success should be an exciting journey toward an amazing destination. As the climber George Mallory said, to ascend the mountain, quote, because it's there, end quote, it feels instead like an exhausting slog, with all your energy focused on not tumbling off a cliff. Surprisingly, people who fear failure do not need to extinguish the fear itself to become more fearless in order to make themselves happier. Instead, the best way to tame a fear of failure is to hone courage. Stanley Rackman, a psychologist, showed that this in his research in the 1980s and then in the following decades on people in dangerous professions such as paratroopers and bomb diffusers. They too tended to fear failure, and messing up in such cases might be dire indeed. But they were able to tap into reserves of courage to act anyway. As Rackman argues, fearlessness is abnormal and even dangerous because it leads to foolish risk-taking and bad leadership. Courage, on the other hand, helps you balance prudence and resolve, even if the only thing you're diffusing is an office conflict. The good news is that all three of these drivers, an aversion to uncertainty, an attachment to the appearance of perfection, and a lack of courage, are qualities most of us would rather rid ourselves of. Facing the fear of failure is more than just dealing with a problem. It is an opportunity to grow in virtue. You can start this growth with three practices. One, focus on the present. I once had a conversation with an oncologist about what it's like to give people a dire, late-stage cancer diagnosis. He said that in some of his patients, people with a particular need to control tightly all parts of their lives, would immediately go home and start researching their prognosis on the internet. He would counsel them not to do this, because it would only make them sick with worry. Instead, he told them, start each day with this mantra, I do not know what will happen next week or next year, but I know I have a gift of this day, and I will not waste it. He said it helped not just their outlook about the disease, but also their overall approach to life. I recommend the same refrain to anyone suffering from a fear of failure. Own the unknown future through gratitude for a known present, and watch your happiness rise as you enjoy what you have in front of you. 2. Visualize courage. Remember that one of the most common fears of failure involves public speaking. Even the thought of giving a speech in front of a group makes some people panic. The solution to this problem is simple: exposure. That doesn't mean you need to haul a soapbox to your town square every day. Just simulating a speech environment using virtual reality has been shown to lower people's fear significantly. Anyone can use this idea, even without strapping on a VR simulator, through simple concentrated imagination. Instead of avoiding the source of your fear, even in your own mind, spend time each day visualizing scary scenarios, including possible failures. Picture yourself acting with courage despite the fear. I did this extensively early in my teaching career, imagining everything from the prosaic, forgetting my notes, to the absurd, realizing after an hour-long lecture that my fly was unzipped the whole time, something that subsequently happened in real life. I soon found that I was, in fact, more courageous in front of a class as a result. 3. Litanize humility. In Dante's Divine Comedy, Satan is depicted as a victim of his terrible pride by being frozen from the waist down, fixed and in agony, in ice of his own making. Fear of failure and perfectionism are like that prideful sea of ice, freezing you in place with thoughts of what others will think of you, or worse, what you will think of yourself if you do not succeed at something. There is a solution that follows Dante's Catholic sensibility, but that in reality need not be religious at all. An early 20th century Spanish cardinal, Rafael Mary de Val y Celutia, composed a beautiful prayer called the Litany of Humility. The prayer does not ask that we be spared humiliation, but that we be given the grace to deal with the fear. From the fear of being humiliated, deliver me, O Jesus. It continues, deliver me from the fear of being despised, from the fear of suffering rebukes, from the fear of being slandered, from the fear of being forgotten, and from the fear of being ridiculed. Make your own version of the Litany of Humility, religious or not, and recite it each night, even if the items seem ridiculous to you. From the fear of messing up my PowerPoint presentation, deliver me. If you want relief, you have to state your desire. Only then will your fear cease to be a phantom menace and instead become concrete and thus conquerable. If all of the above strategies seem too time-consuming, there is one last tried-and-true method to develop courage in the face of failure. Fail. And then survive what the dark unknown truly holds. That is what eventually cured me. As I started by telling you, my music career was made miserable by my terror of mistakes. But at least my mouth was occupied with the instrument, so I didn't have to speak publicly. That really freaked me out. Both those fears came together one fateful day at a chamber music concert at Carnegie Hall in New York. I was slotted to give a short speech, maybe 2 minutes, about a piece my ensemble was to play. I stepped out of my chair and walked to the front of the stage, shaking in fear. Then I lost my footing and literally fell into the audience. Decades later, I can still see it happening, in slow motion. As the audience gasped, I jumped up, my horn badly damaged and my arm injured, and shouted ridiculously and implausibly, I'm okay, folks. Years later, I look back at that experience and laugh, but it wasn't just funny. It was an incredible gift. Since scoring a perfect 10 in humiliation that day, I care very little about looking ridiculous. I take more risks and show my personality in ways I don't think I would otherwise. Failure set me free. Now, from the science section, The Allies Left a Mess in the Ocean, by Paul Haukanis. Aboard the Alcor, a 55-meter oceanographic vessel anchored in the Baltic Sea, several kilometers, from the German port city of Kiel, the engineer Heinrich Schoenheit grips a joystick-like lever in his fist. He nudges the lever up, and a one-of-a-kind robotic sea crawler, about the size of a two-seat golf cart, responds, creeping forward along the seafloor on rubber caterpillar tracks 12 meters below the ship. As the crawler inspects Kiel Bay's sandy terrain, a live video stream beams up to a computer screen in the cramped room aboard the ship. The picture is so crystalline that it's possible to count the tentacles of a translucent jellyfish floating past the camera. A scrum of scientists and technicians ooh and ah as they huddle around the screen, peering over Schoenheit's shoulder. The bright yellow robot is the Norpa 300, the newest fabrication of the explosive ordnance disposal company CTERRA, which operates out of northern Germany. CTERRA's co-founder Dieter Gulden rates as one of Europe's canniest experts for salvaging sunken explosives. Now, after years of experience clearing the seafloor of hazards for commercial operations and campaigning the German government for large-scale remediation, CTERRA is one of three companies participating in the first-ever mission to systematically clear munitions off a seafloor in the name of environmental protection. The arduous and exacting process of removing and destroying more than 1.5 million tons of volatile munitions from the Baltic and North Sea basins, an area roughly the size of West Virginia, is more urgent by the day. The weapons, which have killed hundreds of people who have come into accidental contact with them in the past, are now corroded. Their casings are breaking apart and releasing carcinogens into the seas. CTERRA's top technicians aboard the Alcor are testing the Norpa 300's basic functions in the wild prior to the project's start early this month, ensuring that its steering, sonar imaging of the seafloor, chemical sampler, and video feed are fine-tuned. Everyone huddled in the ship's dry lab watches rapt as the crawler bumps up against a vaguely rectangular object the size of a bar fridge. It's largely obscured by seaweed and, from the looks of it, home to a lone Baltic flounder that's swimming around the base. Aaron Beck, a senior scientist at Geomar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research, a German marine research institute working along CTERRA, identifies it as an ammunition crate. "Look at the flatness there, the corner. That's not of the natural world," he explains. "Dumped munitions lie in waters across the world, but are ubiquitous in German waters. In the aftermath of the Second World War, all the conflicting parties, including the United Kingdom, Russia, Japan, and the United States, had to divest themselves of armaments. They didn't want them on land, and facilities to destroy them were too few," explains Anita Kunitzer of the German Environment Agency. "Dumping at sea, a practice held over from the First World War, was the obvious choice." Experts estimate that a ginormous 1.6 million tons of conventional munitions and another 5,000 tons of chemical weapons lie decomposing off Germany alone in the North and Baltic Seas, most from the Second World War. If all that weaponry were lined up, it would stretch from Paris to Moscow. "Nowhere in German waters is there a square kilometer of seabed without munitions," says Gulden. In the post-war decades, freelancing scrap metal collectors hauled explosives and other valuables, wartime debris, ashore to hawk on the metals market. Fisher boats that ensnared unexploded munition in their nets were required to turn them into the coastal authorities, not toss them overboard again. The German Navy's anti-mine units attempted to clear some of the mess, usually through initiating underwater explosions, but lacked the proper equipment to tackle the problem systematically. Only when the private sector picked up operations did a whole new suite of technology and skill set emerge. Since the late 2000s, CTERRA has been mapping the sunken armaments as they work to clear safe patches of seafloor for wind farm, cable, and pipeline projects. But until this year, CTERRA never possessed the remit it has long coveted to begin systematically ameliorating the seafloor for the sake of marine ecosystems and the people dependent on them. The German government has set aside 100 million euros to remove the toxic mess from the Bay of Lübeck off the Baltic city, port city of Lübeck, southeast of Kiel, as a pilot project. No other country in the world has ever attempted or achieved this, says Tobias Goldschmidt, the regional environments minister, in a press release. Their goal is to recover 50 to 80 tons of munitions, though the pilot's primary purpose is for CTERRA and two other firms to test their technology. Then it's about scaling up and getting faster. Faster is vital because in their watery graves, the many land and naval mines, U-boat torpedoes, depth charges, artillery shells, chemical weapons, aerial bombs, and incendiary devices have corroded over almost 80 years. The Germans, like other dumping nations, long assumed that when the casings broke down, the vast ocean would simply dissolve pollutants into harmless fractions. About 25 years ago, scientists discovered that, instead, the explosives remain live and now are oozing into the ecosystem and up to the food chain. That flounder darting in front of the crawler's camera from the Alcor's dry lab, it almost certainly contains traces of TNT, the highly toxic compound used in explosives. Scientists have also found toxic concentrations of TNT in Atlantic purple sea urchins, mysid crustaceans, and blue mussels. Once contaminants have escaped into the water, they can't be recovered, Stensi points out. So we're working against time. German health experts recommend that consumers limit themselves to no more than two meals of local fish a week to reduce exposure to heavy metals, dioxins, or PCBs. The sources of most of these contaminants are industrial processes and the burning of fossil fuels. TNT does not figure into the guidelines. Nonetheless, the risk of TNT and other contaminants from weapons is enough to cause Stressy herself to steer clear of all Baltic Sea mussels. The risk of immediate loss of life is also ever present. Most of the submerged weapons remain as powerful as the day they were dumped. This is the end of part one of this story. We'll read the second part of this article on the October 9th episode. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.